for the presence of each one this evening. Especially visitors, we want you to know you're welcome. We invite you to study with us. I want to take you on a trip to South America tonight and consider the archaeological evidence there from the perspective of one who believes in God's divine revelation, believing that the same Creator who created those here in North America also created the ones in South America, which maybe we forget sometimes. There are at least four major lessons that I think we can learn from the evidence from South America, and I hope that they will be obvious before we're finished tonight. I want to begin with a statement by William Prescott, who is not a believer. He's a secular historian. In his classic book, The Conquest of Peru, he begins with a statement that is amazing to a lot of people. The evolutionary history of man tells us that it wasn't too many thousands of years ago that we were dragging the mate by the hair of the head and the club in the other hand and saying, ugh, pretty stupid. And now we've gotten really smart. As time has progressed, we have evolved and become more sophisticated. With the possible exception of the last few hundred years, the actual history that we see from archaeology turns that picture upside down. And we see sophistication from the beginning. And things appear to have gone downhill. But notice his statement, referring to the memorials of the past there in Peru, the remains of temples, the aqueducts, other public works, which, to whatever degree of science they may display in their execution, astonish by their number, by the massive character of the materials, by the grandeur of the design. In other words, this is not what you expect when you look back to ancient history. And that becomes very, very dramatic as we go to Peru and to Bolivia. Beginning in Peru, down near Nazca, on the coastline, about 200 kilometers south of Lima, where we've spent a good bit of our time. And if you get there, if you come by car, you'll probably travel by the scenic Pan-American Highway. That kind of flatters it. But it's not exactly a lush countryside, is it? There are places in Peru where it hasn't rained for the past 100 years. And you wonder how in the world anybody could make a living, how animals could survive. Now, there are places where it's green, but that's where they've learned to irrigate. And not too many other places. And this desert that we're looking at goes right up to the coastline without a blade of grass anywhere to be seen. As you get to the coastline, then of course you have life in the sea, and then, as is often the case in desolate areas, you see the pelicans. And the Bible speaks of that in reference to desolate areas. But there's nothing there but desert and the pelicans. I was in this area because we were investigating a very credible report of an astounding bit of evidence that got away from us. Here we see Dr. Javier Cabrera, who was professor and head of the Department of Medicine at the University of Lima for 20 years. Established the largest teaching hospital in Peru, performed the first heart transplant, one of the most famous medical scientists in Peru, and then retired to be cultural anthropologist for Inca. A colleague of mine, Dr. Dennis Swift, was traveling there, and the two of them had talked, and Dr. Cabrera told him of this skull that was embedded in a tertiary boulder. Tertiary is the period just barely above the dinosaurs. So it's supposed to be 60 million years old. man's been around about 2 million, we're told, and so 60 million, 2 million. Boy, this is really going to tear up their playhouse. And certainly a man of this stature in the medical community knows what a human skull is, and he said that's what it was, and he had this picture. So we decided we're going to go down and pick up this 20-ton boulder, we estimated, and take it back to Texas. And we had the logistics of that all worked out. When we got there, however, there was a hole where the skull was. And Dr. Swift had mentioned to a reporter while he was there what they had found, and he told it in the newspaper, and the evolutionist said, we're not going to have this, and it was obviously destroyed by the time we got there. But it did then bring me in contact with Dr. Javier Cabrera, who lived in this mansion, this castle, a remnant from the period when the conquistadors were there. His ancestors were among them. And he had retired. He had a museum in the front part of his castle full of about 11,000 of these burial stones. His father had begun to collect these burial stones in the 30s, and then he had continued and had now 11,000 of them. The ones that we're looking at here depict the gods that they had worshipped in the Nazca culture about 2,000 years earlier, and they had also carved those same figures into the desert floor. Maybe some of you have heard of these Nazca lines. The unique thing about this carving is that it is almost a quarter of a mile from the front to the back. And this is a picture that's taken from an airplane looking down at it. Standing down there, you can't tell what it is. And how do you stand down there where you'd have to be to carve it and then know where to go with the lines and draw this kind of thing? Well, you have to be a pretty sophisticated mathematician. Several universities have tried to replicate that and couldn't, but I think we've figured out at least something about what they did. Here we see the hummingbird, which was one of their gods, and then this giant spider. But again, we're looking at hundreds of yards in dimension, almost a quarter of a mile from top to bottom. Some of you may have heard von Doniggen's claim that here among these Nazca lines are the carvings of ancient astronauts, and here's one of them waving back at you. And a lot of people swallow that. It was refuted a long time ago, but still we run into that. And that's not what it is, especially when you look with the infrared photography. You see this is a fisherman holding a stringer of fish with a net in the other hand. And as you click back, you can see that's exactly what that is. But these were representations of their gods. Their gods lived in the sky. They wanted the gods to see them, so they made them big enough so the gods could see them from way up in the sky. Pretty obvious and reasonable explanation of it. Another thing that I think helped them do this is the fact that they could get up in the air and see them. How, when you get up in the air and look, you say, well, yeah, that's the only way you can see them. But we find from Dr. Woodman that we have documentation that they were flying over 2,000 years ago. What Kon-Tiki discovered about man's mastery of the sea, and this is where they took the reed boats there from Peru and went all the way across the ocean to Australia, showing that they could circumnavigate the globe 2,000 and 3,000 years ago, and we have abundant evidence for that, and we'll look at more of it later. They actually recreate the flying machines that ascended from Nazca's desert floor and referred to them as men of stunning sophistication and intelligence. They flew 2,000 years ago, which is not too much like the fellow with the club in the hand. This is a stunning sophistication. They'd actually made what they had described in their journals and in the drawings that they had made that they found from that period. They were idol worshippers. They worshiped the sun. They made the ziggurats, as we find in Babylonia, and we find in Egypt, and we find in Mexico, aligned with the heavenly bodies and used to measure the movements, and they did so very accurately. In fact, like the Mayans that's referred to here, achieved much greater accuracy than we have today. A minus era of 0.0002 of a day, which is much closer to a day than we have in hours, according to Hancock. We see that they were also involved, and Dr. Cabrera is very interested in this as a surgeon, in brain surgery, and this is depicted on the stones in great detail, and then confirmed with a number of skulls from that area that had obviously been operated on, some of them not successfully, but almost all of them were. Like this one, 85% of them were healed, indicating a successful surgery. We don't have 85% success rate today with brain surgery, but they did. And that's depicted on the stones. Again, the sophistication is shocking and certainly different from the evolutionary picture you see in the textbooks. There was vicious debauchery. Here, possibly a cesarean operation, possibly a vicious attack, difficult to tell. But at least a third of these burial stones have the most disgusting pornography that I hope you would never imagine. A great deal of homosexuality that they gloried in and made the, well, I won't describe it, but this is the only book that I could take a photograph of that was talking about it that we could show. There is a museum in Lima, and that's all they have there, the drinking vessels and the pottery and the depictions of the debauchery of that age. That's a museum dedicated to that there in Lima. But the sophistication of that culture was dramatic. They channeled water hundreds of miles from the Andes down to the plains so that they could grow various crops, and used methodology that is very sophisticated. Here are most of the channels were underground, about 50 feet underground. And then to give access to the villages along the way, they would have these spiral accesses where you could go down 50 feet, get the water, and then come back up. And people of the village, quite a few at a time, could go down and do that. In the journal Industrial Research and Development, they described the hydraulic simulations showed that the Chimú channels were completely modern in design. They relied on concepts of fluid dynamics that Western hydrologists only started to apply within the past century, 2,000 years ago. They were not dummies. Perhaps the most interesting thing, though, that we find in the Nazca culture are these huge burial stones, some huge, some small, tremendous variety. But these are of dinosaurs. Now, all of the books will tell you that dinosaurs and man were separated by 100 million years, at least 65, and no man ever saw a dinosaur, and so if you ever find that together, then it just completely explodes their theory. And as you've if you've listened to other lectures on this subject, we've quoted the authorities who speak of the significance of it, and it's time to give up and go home if you find documentation of that. Well, they have to say this was not 2,000 years ago. We've known what dinosaurs looked like for maybe a little over 100 years, and then didn't know very well. But here is a pretty good rendition. Here's one with has a man's foot in his mouth that maybe you can see from the pictures a little closer there. Let me back that up. Shades of Jurassic Park with the dinosaur eating the man. A tremendous variety of materials, of styles, I did bring a professor of art from the University of Texas, Arlington, down with me to examine these stones. He said there were at least 100 different artists that were represented here. Tremendous difference in style. Sometimes they were in combat. Sometimes they appeared to be somewhat domesticated. Most of the time they were fighting, and you see the man chopping the head off. Here, sometimes the dinosaur is getting the better, and sometimes the man. And sometimes it's difficult to tell what's going on. But again, outlines, then more artistic. Here's sort of an oriental style, very different style. This one is extremely well done. The unique thing about this one is the dermal frills on the back of the dinosaur, those little stair steps. We knew about that and learned about it in 1990, that when it was first published in the journal Geology. But they had it depicted correctly 2,000 years ago when Mr. Sinclair made his sign and depicted this critter. He didn't put the stair steps on the back, which we know were there and are accurate. But just to give you an idea, we won't show you all 11,000, but about a third of the 11,000 have dinosaurs on them. Here's that's a cute little female dinosaur. Different styles, some of them like a cartoon, a variety of species. But there could be no question that these individuals have a working knowledge of dinosaurs. This is something that had been seen. Tremendous amount of resistance, and if you go on the internet, you'll find all kind of answers that are just fraudulent, and a lot of lies there. One of the fellows involved in this with Dr. Cabrera was Mr. Achua, and we'll talk about him in a moment. And they worked together. He was a grave robber, and he dug up some of these things, and he got caught selling antiquities in Peru. Is virtually a life sentence. The average life expectancy in a Peruvian prison is 3 years, and the sentence is 5, so he probably wouldn't make it. So he said, no, these are not real, on camera, and they are using that. But he told us, and then said even on camera, that, yes, I made some. The ones I sold were made, but most of what he has is real, even at that point. So you've got a lot of controversy surrounding it, and it has to, I mean, they have to answer this, or the ball game's over for them. To give you an idea of the kind of furor surrounding it, here at the Regional Museum of Inca, we knew that they had some of these stones because we knew the people that had donated them. Carlos Cabrera, several years earlier, had found stones back in the 50s. He was head of the Department of the College of Engineers, the name of it, in Lima, and had found hundreds of these stones on his own, completely apart from Dr. Cabrera, separate confirmation, and then had donated them to the museum. We went there, and this is my colleague standing there posing for the picture. They said, no, we don't have anything like that. And we said, no, wait a minute. We know the people that gave it to you. We've seen the pictures. Here's the documents that said they were given to you. Well, okay, we've got them, but they're in storage. You can't see them. Well, this is supposed to be a museum where you see things, you know, instead of hiding things. Well, for these stones, you have to have an official permission from a state-chartered museum. I said, well, I think we can handle that. He said, well, if you get that official document, we'll allow you to see them. Well, we came back 2 days later with the official document that we had faxed to us. And the director wouldn't even come out and talk to us. Sent the assistant, I'm sorry, he said he would, but he won't, and you can't see him. 2 years later, Dr. Swift, who was working with me at the time, through pressure from the legislature, threatening to cut off their funds, finally got in to see him and didn't get. But this is the kind of opposition that we have, because they don't want to be embarrassed by being like these creationists. And so they just deny it. At the Aeronautical Museum, there were a number on display. There had been many more. They had about 200 on display there. And this, again, is my colleague pointing some of them. There are only about 50 left at this point. And the best ones, the rather unscrupulous director had sold and offered to sell some of these to us. Of course, it would be illegal. But these remain, and you can still see this is the same thing, just some of the poorer examples of it. And they had over 200, now still have 50 on display. We also went to the Keio Museum, Naval Museum, and they had a number on display there. Some of them depicted the pterosaurs, and some of them even with men flying on the pterosaurs, rather. I guess artistic license, but they thought, okay, this is something to do with aeronautics and connected somehow with their museum. Anyway, they decided to collect several of them. Elias, Commander Elias, was the one who had been in charge of that. These are some from his collection, and he decided to loan two of them to our museum, and we have the two outside ones on display here are in the museum in Hot Springs now. And he does have several more good examples there at the Keio Museum, Naval Museum. In the Nazca Museum, which is in the city of Nazca, we have this huge stone that Dr. Swift is holding, almost. And that one also wound up in my museum. It's not purchased, it's on loan, and probably legal. But anyway, that's what they allowed. And so we observed in the Cabrera Museum, in the Museum of Inca, the Nazca Museum, the Aeronautical Museum, and the Keio Museum, these burial stones. And of course, the story is on the internet. Well, Mr. Okeo and Javier Cabrera, these two men carved all 11,000 of them and did it recently, since we've learned what the dinosaurs look like. Well, you go down there and you see there's evidence of them all over the place. We went out to talk to the grave robber who had actually uncovered most of them, and this is the village of Ococea. Now, you may think I'm picking this out as a bad example, but this is actually a pretty good example. You cannot imagine the poverty once you get out of the city of Lima. And in fact, you don't even have to get out of the city, out on the outskirts. They live in cardboard boxes, maybe corrugated metal, but no roof is typical. And it's truly sad. And the landscape looks like this. And that's why I guess they're so poor. It's a pitiful situation. But Basilio Ochoa lives in the nicest house in town, in one of the nicer towns in the area. And he is in charge of robbing graves, which is, of course, not exactly legal. But he supports the village with that, selling vases and various artifacts. And he agreed to take us out to the tombs where there was a legal and authorized dig, authorized by the National University. And notice the nice countryside. This is the boulevard, I guess. Anyway, it goes out to where they had been digging, which had been a very nice area, I guess. This is where they had had a cemetery burying the dead, and you can see that they had done a good bit of digging. The bones are strewed out. That's not what they're interested in. They're interested in what's in the grave. And in this legal dig, we were able to see a number of the mummies that were exposed in the tombs. And you learn a little bit about the people. They had good hair, for one thing. 2,000-year-old hairdo looks pretty good. This one needs a little face cream, I think. But this is a trophy head, and there were numbers of them. That's if you kill your enemy, then you wear the skull on your belt. And they were proud of that. And this is how you got to be somebody that's important. You had a bunch of trophies. And if the mother died and you don't want to take care of these kids, they're not yours, and you just bury the kids with her. And so when you find a mother, you find often children buried with them, as you see here on the skirts of the mother. And that's rather typical. Here at the foot, you see one of the stones, and we several times saw in situ, that is, in place, the stones that had been uncovered by this legal dig by the university, and they're continuing to do so today. Dr. Swift sent one of the stones to University of Bonn in Germany to see if you could date the patina. The patina is this coating that grows over the years, and they were able to do so. This one was excavated in 2005. Dr. Cabrera passed away in 2002, so I don't think he did this one. But the University of Bonn dated it at 2,500 before present, or 2,500 years ago. So the evidence is just abundant in spite of all of the opposition. This is one that was excavated in 2006, and that one has also found its way to our museum on loan. But people say, well, it was all Cabrera, it was all Basilio Ochoa, and he admitted that he carved some. Well, yes, he did, threatened with a 5-year prison sentence and leaving his family without support. But it was absurd to think that he would have carved all of the 11,000, and then you've got sources, a dozen other sources in addition to him. But to just summarize and to pile on, so to speak, let me summarize the sources of confirmation for these stones. The Spanish priest described them back in 1525. These strange animals carved on the stones in the burial tombs, and then the chronicler of the Incas, one of the more famous historians of ancient Incas, wrote of the stones in 1570. Bolivia Cabrera, the father of Javier Cabrera, began collecting in the 30s, and then Dr. Cabrera has a collection now of 11,000. He passed away in 2002, but his collection is still there in the castle. He was professor of medicine at the University of Lima and head of the Department of Medicine. Established the largest teaching hospital in Peru, and then cultural anthropologist for Inca. He has credentials. Then, in addition, Carlos Solti, who was head of the College of Engineers in Lima, excavated the stones in the 50s, and then his brother donated the stones to the museum, who then promised or denied that they had them, promised to show them, and then refused, finally revealed under pressure from the legislature. Basilio Ochoa excavated many of the stones, he told us, and then recanted somewhat on TV on threat of imprisonment. The National Aeronautical Museum displays many of them. The Regional Museum in Nazca does. Dr. Swift and Patton have observed many of those in situ, in the tombs. University of Bonn confirmed and dated the patina, and then the grave robbers continued to excavate them. Now, that's a lot of evidence. It kind of reminds me of the comment that Henry Morris responded to when somebody had listened to his lecture that was just devastating against evolution, and they said, don't you think that may be a little overkill? He just smiled and said, well, I just want to make sure it's dead. And It should be. And the rebuttals on the internet are shameful. In addition to the stones, we have the burial cloths that are also found in the tombs that have dinosaurs on them, as you can see. I have two of these cloths in my collection. And then on the pottery, what does that look like? This is from the National Museum in Lima, 2,500 years ago. And then the Mocha vases, the stirrup vases, many of them have very obvious dinosaur-looking critters on them, and that's from about 2,000 years ago. The gold masks that are typically from northern Peru, likewise, are seen with these critters. Notice the dermal frills across the back and the long tail curling over his back and the big teeth. Sure looks like a dinosaur to me. All of these things together say they were seeing these things 2,500 years ago. And if that's the case, they weren't gone for 65 million years, as the evolutionist is telling us. Then we go across the lake, Lake Titicaca, which divides Peru and Bolivia. And here is the city of La Paz, Bolivia. Had an unfortunate incident as we landed there in La Paz. Had to jump out of an airplane at 13,000 feet without a parachute. Of course, that's the elevation of the airport. We were on the ground at the time. But one of the world's highest airports at 13,000 feet. And there we see the Amari Indians, who were the natives there before the Spaniards arrived. Very interesting stories. I wish we had more time to tell about it. Many of them live on the Altiplano, which is at an elevation of 13,000 feet, and they try to make a living growing potatoes up there. To go to the grocery store is tens of miles by foot, and then they don't have money. They're extremely poor people. But their background goes about as far back as you can find history there, and they have in their background the tradition of Viracocha, the sky god, the creator god, whose son was to sacrifice himself and to redeem the world. They know about that. And when people came with the gospel, they just responded by the thousands. And the gospel went like wildfire through the community. I talked with some of the young kids. They all knew about Viracocha, the sky god, the creator god, and about the sun, and many of them had heard the gospel message. We hear of, we know, as we saw last night, Peter and Paul wound up in Rome and were killed. We know where James wound up in Jerusalem and was killed, but where'd the rest of the apostles go? Their tradition involves Tomas, the man with the book. And I saw several of the statues and ancient pictures of this man with a robe with a codex under his arm. Tomas, man with the book. Indicating, I believe, or it certainly is consistent with the evidence that he came to Peru. Well, they couldn't travel across the ocean. No, we have abundant evidence that they could. One of the most, I wish we had more time to talk about some of that. We, in Turkey, uncovered a map that was collected by a Turkish admiral back in the early 1500s, but he had collected ancient maps, some of them copied from the Library of Alexandria 300 years before Christ. One of those maps, the Piraeus map, shows all five continents, including Antarctica, on a map done 300 years before the time of Christ. And that was published by Dr. Hapgood, who was a professor of geology at the University of New Hampshire, forward written by a very famous scientist, including Albert Einstein. as a part of that testimony. Anyway, we've got good evidence for the fact that they circumnavigated the globe long before Columbus, and that part of the history that we've been taught is actually ridiculous. Notice Prescott's reaction to what he saw among these native peoples. He says it's a remarkable fact that many, if not most, of the rude tribes inhabiting the vast American continent had attained to the sublime conception of the one great spirit, the Creator. Now, he's speaking somewhat accommodatively. He doesn't believe in him. And he's got it backwards. It's not that they evolved to it. It's that they started there and the rest of them devolved from it, who had different ideas. But anyway, they did believe in the Creator of the universe, not to be dishonored by an attempt at visual representation. They were against idolatry. They believed in the one Creator God. And that's what he found in the ancient people there. Among the traditions of importance is one of the deluge, which they held in common with so many nations, all parts of the globe. Orthodox Spaniards who came to the country saw a striking resemblance to the Christian communion. Now, the communion that they had is not exactly like what we read in the New Testament, but nevertheless, what they saw appeared similar to what they knew. Evidence that some of the primitive teachers of the gospel, perhaps an apostle himself, had paid a visit to these distant regions and scattered over them the seeds of religious truth. Strange words from an unbeliever. Maybe he's being affected by this kind of evidence. But recall in Acts chapter 1, Jesus told the apostles, "You're going to be my witnesses just in Samaria and Jerusalem and to the uttermost parts of the earth." And I wonder if he was telling the truth. I think he was, and I think we have evidence here. In fact, the Apostle Paul in Colossians 2 says the gospel was proclaimed in all creation under heaven. And I think we see evidence of that up on the Altiplano at 13,000 feet in Bolivia. It's a very unusual lake that seems to have been raised up with this area and trapped within it secreters. You got seahorses and other animals that you only find in the ocean in this lake. Surrounding it are reeds with which they build boats like this. Some of them fashioned like dragons, which they say lived in the lake in the past. But they build these reed boats shaped in this manner, which are similar to this reed boat, but notice the background. That's not Bolivia, that's Egypt. This is Bolivia. Wow, that's exactly the same, isn't it? Somebody is traveling in these boats, and they did show with Kon-Tiki that they could go all the way to Australia in these boats. And here's the evidence that you've got the same design down in Egypt. Interesting experiment was performed by a professor at the University of Chicago, Alan Colotta, who saw how they were growing potatoes up there 1,500 to 2,000 years ago. And so he reproduced the irrigation technique. They were doing it differently, and we don't have time to go into all the difference, but it was significantly different. This is what was practiced 1,500 years ago by the Tiwanaku people in test plots near modern-day Bolivia's Lake Titicaca. Okay, let's do it the way they did it and see if it makes a difference. The resulting bumper crops, in some cases, seven times the average yield of land farmed using modern technique. I think the farmers in Arkansas would be interested in a technique that would multiply the results seven times. Maybe they need to listen to these people who were doing it 1,500 to 2,000 years ago. When we look at these magnificent temples that were built by the people, the Tiwanaku city there in Bolivia, it It's absolutely mind-boggling, and that's not an exaggeration. There's not a whole lot intact standing because it is an earthquake area. And this solid piece of andesite granite was broken in 1923. That was recorded as a result of an earthquake. Prior to that time, it was one 50-ton plus object. That was their gateway to the sun in their religion. Quarried from a quarry 200 kilometers away. How did they cut that, and how did they transport that 2,500 years ago? Looking at some of the stones that were used to build that temple, notice that they're planed flat, just as perfect as anyone could want. And it's 50 feet long and almost 30 feet wide and 20 feet in depth. These are gigantic stones that are, of course, tumbled now by the earthquake. How did they cut that? How did they transport that? And then you look at the places where they're joined together, and they use this technique where they carve in the top of the stone this staple-shaped indention, and then pour molten metal into it so that it forms these staples that hold those pieces together to resist the earthquake. And it is illustrated here in this example, except this is in Turkey. Wait a minute. This was the technique that we saw in Bolivia. Now then, this is Pergamum, Turkey, and it's exactly the same technique being used in Turkey. And then here it is again, and this doesn't look like Turkey or Bolivia either. This is the jungles of Cambodia, but exactly the same technique from the same period of about 2,000 years ago. Looks like this news is getting around the world, isn't it? Looking at other parts of that Cambodian temple, here the mitered edges were held together by that technique. When we look at the structures that they built, perhaps most dramatically down in Egypt, they began much better than they ended up. And we think that it went the other way. But the first and most glorious was Cheops, the Great Pyramid, not pictured here, but similar to this, much larger than this, but well done. As things proceeded, they got shoddier and shoddier, as we read here from American scientists. The pyramid age had come to an end, lasted for a little more than a century. The pyramids were still being erected, but they rapidly became smaller and shoddier. Now, this is not the way history tells the story, is it? But this is what we see over and over again. One of the mind-boggling things that you see there at Tiwanaku are the ethnic faces that are carved in this sunken garden, which obviously was much more lush and productive in the past. Egyptian faces, Negroid faces, Oriental faces all together 2,000 years ago. Now, how did that happen? Well, they were circumnavigating the globe. This is the obvious Negroid feature. And there's some pretty strange faces that you can see there on the wall. Some of them are now in the museum, but this is a very obvious Egyptian look, as well as this one. But then you don't have to wonder where this one came from either. That's very obvious Negroid, as well as this one, showing some of the tattoo and bodily features, disfigurations that we still see today. And you also see pictures of features like this. I apologize for the slightly fuzzy picture here, but I wasn't supposed to be taking pictures. You've seen that in museums. I don't pay a whole lot of attention to that. But you see obvious Oriental features. This head had been severed from the body, but it was right beside the body. And you look at the back side of the body this head was on. You see that Q down the back. This fellow is from China and was there in Peru with the people from Africa, the Olmecs in Mexico, Guatemala, have a very obvious Oriental look, and these large stone heads depict that Oriental feature. Mike Chu, Texas Christian University, who is a secular scientist, has become rather well known for his exposure or his discovery and confirmation of where the Olmecs came from. And this appeared on ABC News, comparing the artifacts from China with the artifacts of the Olmecs, and they were identical. And the jade that he found in Mexico didn't come from Mexico. It's nothing like, but it is from China. And then the earpieces they put in their earlobes are of the same design and of jade that comes from China. ABC News said Chu has discovered jade stone pottery artifacts attributed to the Olmecs, believed to be ancestors of the Maya, about 1600 to 1100 BC. The artistic motifs on the objects bear an extraordinary resemblance to the Chinese bones inscriptions from the Chang Dynasty, about 1600 to 1100 BC. Discover Magazine, likewise, 3,000 years ago, before the egg roll joined Americans' fast food menu, a group of Chinese immigrants made sail to the New World. Now, they couldn't have traveled around the world. Here, 1,000 years before Christ, the Chinese are doing it. Mike Chu, a linguist at Texas Christian University, has shown proof in their own handwriting, and he compares the Olmecs and the Changs and the modern word for divine. Looks pretty similar. The word for temple, wow, it's pretty much the same in all three. And in the Olmecs, the Chang, and the modern for container, likewise for worship, for small, for offer. The language is just dramatically similar. Discover Magazine says Chang writings date from 1600 to 1100 BC. Traces of the Olmec civilization appear abruptly during this span, around 1200 to 1100 BC. And then Japan, of all people, recognized this. And from the Japan Times, Chinese may have gone to the Americas 3,000 years ago. Chinese arrived in the Americas as early as 3,000 years ago. So the idea they could not have traveled to Peru or around the world to preach the gospel in all creation. Well, the Chinese did. Why couldn't they? As we travel to Cusco, up away from the coast, back toward the mountains, notice these irregular shaped stones. Behind the fellow playing on the instrument. This is part of an ancient fortification, huge, that is just mind-boggling. These stones are individually cut so that they fit next to the one next to it, not to the one that it is then next to. Each one is cut individually. There's no mortar. It fits perfectly, and it's been there for 2,000 years in spite of the earthquakes, and the irregular shape is to resist the forces of the earthquake, which would travel down a straight line very quickly. But some of these stones are huge. As you can see, the workmanship is mind-boggling, and when you separate those connections, you see faint irregularities here at the top that match the ones on the bottom that fit together. And how did they do that? We don't have a clue. Notice again from Nuremberg, what is truly impossible about the block, speaking of this extremely large block in the wall, is that it is the size of a five-story house and weighs an estimated 20,000 tons. We have no combination of machinery today that could dislodge such a weight, let alone move it any distance. Must have been ancient astronauts. No, I don't think so. They had technology. They weren't dummies. Shows the mastery of technology which we as yet have not attained. possibly with canals, but a number of different theories we really don't know. But they weren't dummies. They were a part of a technology, a culture that was extremely prosperous. Gold, all kinds of finery in their clothing and in their architecture, in their engineering, an advanced civilization. And this is the way it looks today. What happened? Something happened. I think God turned their water off. I think we know what happened. It's very similar to what happened in other instances. We do know the kind of culture, the vicious debauchery, the pornography, the homosexuality was rampant, the murder and human sacrifice. This was a culture that was ripe to be judged. You think God could see across the ocean? He knows what's going on. We know what happened according to Ezekiel about Egypt. Egypt was a glorious country, advanced beyond perhaps any other country in the world. But God said, Egypt shall fall because of their debauchery. Their pride, their power shall come down. Now you go to the ruins and you're just in awe of what they were. And in Joseph's time, they fed the world. They can't feed themselves today. Ezekiel said, they shall be desolate in the midst of countries, and her cities shall be in the midst of cities that are laid waste. And you couldn't find a better description of Egypt. You've been there, you see some green along the Nile, you get half a mile from the Nile and it's kitty litter from there on. That's what Ezekiel said would happen. And that's exactly what happened. That was not the way it was. We kind of think, well, that's the way it's been. Back in Genesis chapter 13, when Lot and Abraham were dividing up the country, Lot saw the valley of the Jordan that was well watered like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt. Egypt was like the garden of Eden, well watered. This was lush. In fact, one of the words describing this countryside here could be translated, it is in other places translated jungle. It's not that way in Egypt today. We see indications of it from the hieroglyphics of the lush countryside that would support the world. But today, it's desolate in the midst of desolate countries. He will stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria. Assyria, where Nineveh was. Nineveh, here's the capital, one of the great seven wonders of the world, the Hanging Gardens. That's Iraq right now. I've been there. It's the most desolate place you could ever imagine. But he will destroy Assyria, Zephaniah says, and make Nineveh a desolation as dry as the wilderness. The herd shall lie down in the midst of her, every beast of the nation, and the pelican and the bittern shall lodge on the capitals of her pillars, and the voice shall sing in the windows, and desolation shall be at the threshold. The pelican and the porcupine shall possess it, and also the owl and the raven shall dwell on it, and he shall stretch out over it the line of confusion and the stones of emptiness. That's a perfect description of what you see in the ruins of Nineveh and Babylon and Egypt and Israel, which received the same condemnation. God turned their water off. You're going to be desolate. And that's the way it is. I think that's exactly what happened in Peru. I think it's obvious when you look at the previous culture and the way it is now. Solomon said, righteousness exalts a nation, but sin is a disgrace to any people. One of the things that we forget is that the prophecies that describe the coming Messiah, and then that description that we find of him now reigning in Revelation, is of one who rules the nations, not who did. In Revelation 19, verse 15, so that he may smite the nations, and he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. Do you think he forgot how to do that? He did it in Israel. He did it in Egypt. He did it in Assyria. I believe he did it down in Bolivia and Peru. And what does our nation look like today? When we see that there is one who judges nations, and we see America following the same course, it ought to make us shake in our boots. This is serious. We need to pray for our country and pray for our president and hope that we can turn some things around. But let's bring this to a conclusion, looking at what we should take from our trip down to South America. We see clearly that evolutionary history is wrong. They were advanced and sophisticated and brilliant in the past, and if anything, it's gone downhill. Certainly man and dinosaur coexisted. We see that not only with the stones, which are well verified, but with the burial cloths and the mask and the vases and the pottery. And if they did coexist and they're not 100 million years apart and the geologic column is wrong, and evolution collapses according to the evolutionary authorities. We can see that travel enabled preaching in all creation, an indication that it had been done in the past there in Peru. And there's documentation that that capacity was certainly there. And when we look at the various ethnicities that are represented 2,000 years ago, it becomes obvious. And we see that the Messiah judges nations. And he may judge us if we don't come to repentance. Powerful lessons that we can see from archaeology in South America. Perhaps you're here this evening and haven't confessed your faith. There is abundant evidence to believe that God is, that He, His Son, now rules, and He requires that we submit to Him. If we do, we'll have blessings beyond our imaginations, both here and hereafter. And so we plead with you to respond confessing your faith, repenting your sins, and being baptized into Christ, as that accurate book describes and demands. If you've done that, become unfaithful, you need to come back and confess and pray so that you can be restored. Won't you do so while we stand together and sing?